A number of questions that have come up from the crowd, as well as some from me, if I can start. Desmond, in looking at some of the implications, some of the lessons from the GFC, one area I was interested in exploring was, which I don't think you touched on, was the impact of remuneration models, the remuneration of individuals, especially senior individuals, on behaviour, and the extent to which that may have impacted the GFC, but also looking forward, whether there would be any potential role of regulation to influence those remuneration models.
I think. Can you hear? Hello.
Yeah, you're good.
The notion that remuneration influences behaviour, I think, is ridiculous. I'm pulling your leg on that one. I think it has been one of the major issues, but I believe there are two sides to this. I'm quoting from a document. I was concerned you were going to ask that question. The document said that one of the big problems identified during the global financial crisis is the bonus structure of many overseas banks. Many banking executives believed that they were entitled to big bonuses even when their banks clearly failed and were dependent on taxpayer funds to save their banks. I mean, this has been a major issue. Fortunately, a conclusion by our Financial Services Board in South Africa was that bonuses in the South African financial services sector appear to not be substantially out of line with those in other sectors. I think there are two aspects to this. One is clearly if one is remunerating people for behavior that will lead to the creation of shareholder value, and one is looking for an alignment between the interests of shareholders and other stakeholders and management. My own view, and I touched on this earlier in what I had to say, that was the issue wasn't the remuneration and the bonus structuring as such, but was ineffective governance structuring. And if boards and particularly audit committees and where appropriate risk committees were doing their job, they would have seen to it that positions were not taken by the financial institutions which led to the problems that they led to. So I'm all for paying remuneration to align, as I say, the interests of all stakeholders, but I'm even more for effective governance, which ensures that unreasonable positions are not taken in the interest solely of the remuneration of management.
Thanks, Desmond. Seamus, you outlined a number of challenges in the world of 2016. In particular, the challenge of communicating some complex results across a wide range of aspects. How ready do you think that the profession is to take on that challenge?
It's a good question. I think it's becoming more ready. I think the speaking specifically for the profession in the UK and Ireland, I think there's been a very strong emphasis on development of soft skills. We have a communications examination. We are building improvement of communication skills and creating opportunities for people to develop their communication skills into our strategy going forward. Nevertheless, I think we have a long way to go. I mentioned my experiences in board contexts. I still might have to say it's a minority of even those holding senior actuarial positions who are there. But there's 5 years to go to 2016, so I'm an optimist.
Hazel, you see actuaries in a complex world of, in fact, an increasingly complex world from your presentation. What's your view on the readiness of the profession to cope with communication of more complex concepts?
I think I've certainly seen a big change, and I think a change for the better in terms of the the readiness of the profession to really push the boundaries and to focus more on dealing with complex issues and communicating effectively complex issues. So I'm really quite encouraged, and I do see a significant role for the profession in this world. In fact, I was at a conference just a couple of weeks ago when some of the challenges associated with the world that we live in were being discussed, and in particular, the challenges around managing some of the risks. And there was a lot of discussion about some of the behavioral characteristics that really mean that in a fundamental sense, we're not that really well suited to dealing with some of these risks. And one of the comments that I thought was really actually quite a compliment, although it perhaps wasn't said in that way, was, well, one of the ways we can deal with these risks is we can dehumanize people by training them as actuaries. Which I actually thought was—it probably wasn't meant as a compliment, but I'm an optimist, so I can always find something good in everything. But I think on a perhaps a more serious note, I think underlying that comment probably was quite a strong message about the role of actuaries in the world that we're in.
Okay, so there were a couple of specific points that people wanted to follow up. Seamus, the provocative idea that the model would be owned by the risk management team. The question, in practice, especially when it comes to technical provisions, how that might actually work?
Sure. The Solvency II legislation identifies a number of distinct governance functions, internal audit, compliance, but specifically risk management and actuarial. And I think that's a conceptual distinction, which I think is probably valid. The directive also says, or the supporting measures also say, that it's entirely possible for, say, the conceptually distinct functions of actuarial and risk management to be discharged by a single person. But that person does have to remember what hat they're wearing at any given time. And I think that's probably a reasonable way to go. And in terms of perhaps some of the cultural background of particularly the actuarial profession in continental Europe, which has traditionally been very liability-focused, it's probably a reasonable distinction to make. But I very much hope that we will see, to an increasing degree, actuaries either holding the risk management function or holding a combined risk management and actuarial function, depending on the nature and complexity of the organisation.
So you'd see them not only work more closely, but perhaps some sort of merger of those roles?
I think it's useful to keep the conceptual distinction, because technical provisions is a high-volume production job. You're concerned about the middle of probability distributions. Risk management, you're more concerned with issues of controls and the extremes of distributions. Mm-hmm. So there's some different mindsets, but I believe many actuaries can wear two hats and can think from different perspectives at different times.
Mm-hmm. Could I perhaps just comment on that? It's a debate we've been through at Sanlam for the last 18 months, is the role of the chief risk officer and the chief actuary. And we've concluded on no less than four occasions that it's actually, in our context, desirable for have those two functions being performed by the same individual. The question, of course, arises, is the workload too extreme? And we've solved that by propping the functions up with adequate support. But in our mind, it's highly desirable to have those two functions in a life company residing in the same individual.
Mm-hmm. So, Desmond, what I've got you, given your role as chairman on a couple of boards, how does the board get some confidence that risks are going to be identified, that we're not going to have some things falling through the gaps?
We've got in our group structure, we have an arrangement of having group risk and audit committees down through the organization. dealing with the different areas of risk management, of short-term or non-life, of life, of employee benefits. And we have people who we believe are adequately qualified to understand those businesses down at the subsidiary levels, the audit and risk committees at those levels. And the reporting, and the chief risk officer sits in on all those meetings, and the reporting at board or the group level is very much on an exception sort of basis. So I think it's having the trust and confidence in the fact that through the organization at the different levels you've got people that are adequately trained and experienced with the right mandate and empowered to do what you're expecting from them.
Seamus, have you got a view, given your scenario of going to the board and covering some commentary on risks? What's your, where does the board get its confidence from?
I'd go back to what I said about reconciling top-down and bottom-up perspectives. Mm-hmm. I'm a strong believer in the trend and potentially, at least in the banking sector, the requirement for boards to have specialist risk committees, mm-hmm. which focus their attention on risk. And I think it's quite important that the board feels empowered to ask any question and also to have a balance as between non-executive and executive involvement in risk committees, such that the non-executive questioning can be very strong. There's no perfect solution, but a culture of encouraging questioning, no matter how apparently outlandish, I think certainly can help. And then integrating that with the perspectives coming up from the specialists who know and understand the risks is, I think, the key challenge.
Okay, thank you. I might move to some of the investment themes that Hazel provocatively presented. So it's a question that you made some reference to alternative assets and a query about the role of hedge funds and in particular the extent to which the concerns about liquidity and transparency of hedge funds. How do you see them in your future world of alternative investments?
Yeah, thanks. Perhaps I can start by coming back to a theme that I've already talked about in terms of labels. Lots of things are called hedge funds. We found, to our cost during the GFC, that a number of the things that we called hedge funds, which were meant to be uncorrelated alpha strategies, were actually nothing more than leveraged, and in some cases very highly leveraged, beta strategies. Now, they don't obviously add anything at all to your diversification, but do certainly add a lot to your risk. So my answer on hedge funds is yes, but you've got to look. I do think that they have a role, but you've got to look well beyond the label of hedge fund and look at actually what the manager is doing, what the strategy is, and form a judgment as to whether that does provide some uncorrelated alpha, and also how is that alpha, assuming you've decided it exists, how is it going to perform in different market conditions? Now, those are not easy things to do, I agree, but that, I believe, are the key things you need to look at when you're looking at hedge fund investing. Obviously, we also know that hedge funds are not necessarily... Some hedge fund strategies are very liquid. Some are not so. And I think that is one, obviously, again, of the considerations that you need to look at in the context of the overall liquidity budget that the particular fund has. And of course, one of the challenges is, well, how do you spend that liquidity budget or illiquidity budget wisely?
Okay. The other one, you've in the spotlight, as it were. Some broad questions around the implications of a greener world, the concerns about climate change, the extent to which that adds to the different investment world in the future.
Yeah. As you've probably worked out, if you haven't by now, you're probably asleep. I am an optimist. And so I tend to have a philosophical view that when things get tough, we will apply some ingenuity to the problem and we will address it. I lived in South Africa, for example, when they started to produce, when Sasol started to produce oil from coal, which was at that time pretty revolutionary and a real response to obviously a significant problem that South Africa had at that time. So I'm not at all dismissive of environmental challenges. They are certainly there, and I think one of the things that we will unfortunately probably continue to see is increasing volatility in weather patterns, etc. And I do think that investment strategies are going to need to adapt to those things. But I guess I'm not of the view that this is all going to come to some dreadful kind of nasty end, and that environmental issues or food food shortages or whatever are going to end up causing massive disruption to financial markets. I think that we will find ways to deal with those things. But that is going to be part of my overall thesis of volatility, changing correlations, and winners and losers.
Yeah, thank you. The other thing that's come up from a couple of speakers is that of innovation, but from Desmond's experience of perhaps not picking up the critical illness concept when it came, but also the more risk-averse world. And the lack of innovation when people are looking over their shoulders. So what is, thinking about 21st century and this risk-averse aspect, what needs to be different in our thinking to be still open to innovation, or to how can we get away from that risk-averse mentality if innovation is going to be real in our roles? Desmond, you want to take the one first?
To think about that.
You may think.
Not any other comments.
Janice, so. Hazel?
I'll have a go at that if you want while someone else is thinking. I made a comment, I think, that was designed to be relatively provocative and was certainly focused on Australia in terms of what I saw or I see as a potential risk of less innovation than I would see as optimum, particularly in terms of superannuation fund strategies. I think the issue is quite easy to see why that kind of situation may come about. We have a lot of convergence. We have a lot of in terms of these funds, a lot of mergers of funds. So there are increasingly a small number of funds, therefore a small number of decision makers making decisions on what is in total a very large amount of assets. We also have in Australia a pretty concentrated consulting environment. We have four or five major investment consultants. Now, that is really different to a lot of other markets. In the US, for example, there's no investment consultant that has more than about a 1.5% market share. So I think we can see why I'm certainly suggesting in an Australian context, we've got a little bit of a risk of lack of innovation. What do we need to do about it? Well, Roger Irwin, who some of you would know from Towers Watson, was out here not that long ago, and he said, and I think it's very true, Australians need to get out more. And I think we do. We need to open our eyes. There are a lot of, I believe that on a global basis, innovation has probably never been more vigorous. We have continuing innovation happening at a rapid rate, as I said, in a number of developed markets. But we also now have, I believe, real innovation happening in some of the newer markets. So there's not a lack of innovation on a global basis. I think that perhaps in Australia we need to be, certainly in a superannuation context, a bit more open to it.
Perhaps I, having thought about it, perhaps I could make one or two comments. In our own context, I see the innovation that's going to be taking place over the next number of years is going to be in the asset management environment. I think that's where the opportunities are going to lie. What concerns me in the more traditional life environment is that we are so internally focused into other things such as Solvency II, treating customers fairly, and all those good things, into compliance-type issues, that it's concerning that changes in regulation may stifle innovation and product development. And in an organization such as ours that has been around for almost 100 years now, one of the issues, too, is the legacy systems that you're sitting with. You're sitting with this huge IT infrastructure, which is going to have to be changed to enable us to be compliant with Solvency II and our own SAM solvency assessment and management. There are going to be very significant IT changes that are going to be required in the treating customers fairly regime. And that's a huge concern to me, that either we're going to be regulated into not innovating, or that the capacity to implement innovations is going to be reduced by IT constraints. I think it might not be the same year in Australia or elsewhere, but in my company's case, it's a very different consideration.
No, I share your concern. I'd love to stay and chat, but we did promise delegates morning tea at about now. Before with formal thanks to our speakers, a couple of reminders. Firstly, that we'll be expecting the chairs and the speakers for the concurrent sessions to remain and have a chat with Melinda. I think we might gather perhaps over in this corner, might be a good spot, immediately after the session. We have, as you've already heard from Desmond, a very special guest speaker at lunchtime today, the president of the International Actuarial Association, Cecil Bykirk. So please ensure that you've got your buffet lunch and you're seated in plenty of time to listen to Cecil. And don't forget the feedback forms, the Institute one, the two-pager, and you'll need those one pages for the concurrent sessions. So if you might join me in thanking individually our wonderful speakers to open the program with the international influencers, Seamus Creedon, Desmond Smith, and Hazel McNeely. Thank you very much.